How's everybody doing this week? Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. Great show coming up. Really fun interview. Interesting interview with a very cool person. I'll tell you about in a second. Little program note. The name of the podcast is changing. It has changed to The Paul Mercurio Show. We dropped the two chairs and a microphone part because people were hearing that I had a podcast and they were Googling my name, but they couldn't find the podcast and they weren't sure if two chairs and a microphone was my podcast. It was getting confusing for people. So it's now The Paul Mercurio Show. You'll see the new artwork for the show and everything. So tell your friends, tell your family, send out postcards, all that stuff. Couple of random thoughts. Please stop bringing little dogs on airplanes. I just went down and did a benefit in Florida, and each of the flights, there were like a couple little dogs. Stop pretending that you have emotional issues and getting a letter from your doctor and bringing these goddamn dogs on the plane. They're small. They're annoying. Yes, they bark. No, they're not happy. They're sitting in a bag. You know, leave them home. Get them a babysitter. Strap them to the wing. You know, dogs like to stick their nose outside the window of a car. I would think that they like being on the wing of an airplane going 700 miles an hour, having that wind go up their nostrils. Just please stop bringing these dogs on. And you see these people and they're totally fine. They're not, they don't need the dog. We know they don't need the dog. They know they don't need the dog. You know, everybody's in on the scam. Just leave the friggin' dog home, okay? And if you can't leave the dog home, then don't travel. And if you can't not travel and you can't leave the dog at home, then I would just leave the back door open and let the dog run away, okay? He'd be happier. He's going to be out in the woods where he should be, you know, shitting and pissing, instead of on a plane stuck underneath a seat in a bag having to, you know, listen to stupid announcements. All right, you get my point. If you're one of these people with the thing, with the letter, the fake letter that says you have emotional distress issues and you need to have your dog, stop it. Just stop it now, because it's the end of the universe as we know it, if this continues. I saw a rat the other day running with a whole green apple in its mouth. This is not a joke. This is true. The sad thing is I'm so jaded that I live in New York City now that all I could think was, oh, he's got an apple in his mouth. Good for him. He's working out. He's eating healthy. That's all I could think of. Like, you know, instead of thinking, oh, that's gross, it's like, eh, you know, he's eating healthy. That's a pretty cool rat. I needed a moment there to had a little gas, air, burp. The other thing is when you're getting in line, like you're waiting to get on the plane and they start to pre-board, so then everybody moves up to like the desk area where you're kind of standing and like waiting, you know, where the, you know, just before you kind of actually go up and hand them your boarding ticket. Can you not cut right in front of me? Like I was in the line and then there was about 6 inches of space between me and the person in front of me, because that's what you normally do. You leave a little space. And this, it's always older people who think like the plane's going to take off without them. And they jam themselves in between me and the person in front of me. Then they start to back their fat old Depends covered ass into mine, and I can't move, and then I get agitated because I'm like, you know, and then I said something. I said, you know, the plane's not leaving. Why do you have to shove your ass in between me and the person in front of me? You're going by rows or zones anyway. It's not like it's not a free-for-all. This isn't a rock concert or, you know, where you're going and it's general admission, and so everybody's fighting to get their way to the front. So just stop it and stop being somebody who doesn't need those little carts where they drive you around in the airport or they push you. I see a lot of people that don't look old and don't look very infirm, that just look either lazy or just they don't want to work out and they just want to be pushed around on those things. So the dog has to stop. The getting pushed around on these in these little wheelchair cart things, whatever they are, when you don't really need it. And this nonsense of just elbowing your way to the front of the line when you're waiting to get on, you know? If you want to get on first, you know what? Drop a couple of $1,000 and fly first class. How about that? Okay? Otherwise, if you're going to be a cheap son of a bitch like the rest of us, stand in line. When you get in the line, that's where you are in the line. Okay? So annoying. I think that you lose all civil and legal rights if you refuse to move out of a doorway when there are rush of people trying to get in. I mean, like a subway door opens and you stand right in the doorway, or an elevator door opens and you stand right in the doorway, or if you're walking up a set of steps, say in a train station, there's this dude and he's standing right at the corner of the steps and people are trying to go around and he won't move and he's just standing there. And of course, I say something. I'm like, hey, you see everybody's trying, and he's looking at me like I'm the asshole, and he won't move. And there's no room for people to go, so we get backed up, and then I miss the train because this a-hole won't move from the top of the steps where he could just step literally like 6 inches and everything's fine. But no, he's got to be fucking... So if you're that person, or the, you know, the door opens, and in a subway, let's say, or any situation where there's an opening and the doors open, elevator, and they just stand right there. Now, there's room for them to move in so people can get in and out. So you can do the math. Like, you cut down the size of the opening in half, and you got a throng of people trying to get through. They can't get through, okay? So you move out of the way, or I get to tase you. Like, that's the rule now. Or you move to the woods, because clearly you're acting like an asshole who doesn't want to interact with people. So just move to the woods, you know, shit in your hand, drink your own urine to survive, eat berries, and you don't have to, you can stand wherever you want. You can stand in front of a cave where a bear likes to go in and fuck with him and see how he feels about it. But for God's sake, move out of the goddamn doorway or the stairway or anything else, okay? Just stop cock blocking the world, okay? We get it. You're important, okay? Oh, God, I'm getting frustrated here. I'm telling you, I think I'm going to shoot somebody. I was thinking, you know, the Last Supper had to be tense. I mean, you know, I grew up Italian family. You'd have these big Sunday dinners. Everybody's talking around the table. What are you going to chit-chat with Jesus about? You know, he knows what's going to go down. You know what it's going to go down. You're like one of the apostles. What are you going to do, talk to him about the food? Hey, this is... So some hummus, Jesus. Oh, thank you. It was 6 schmeckles for a ha. Like, what's he going to say? Me, I'd start complaining. Ah, fish again? We get it. There's fish out there, and you can make more fish. Oh, great, bread. Yeah, didn't see that coming. You know, I mean, and you don't want to be complaining. The Son of the Lord and the thing, and he's going to... his maker and see his, it's, you know, I'd just bitch. I'd be like, oh man, you hear all that banging and sawing last night? It was like, geez, Christ, they were building a cross out there. Like, it just wouldn't be good. I'd stick my foot in my mouth so many times, it'd be ridiculous. I just don't know what you chit-chat would be. Very awkward to chit-chat with Jesus. It's like, you won't want to make eye contact with him, right? It's not like you can go to the bathroom and check your cell phone for a couple of minutes just to kill some time, you know? What are you going to do? You got to just sit there and, oh my God, what a beautiful day it was today. Too bad you won't see it tomorrow. Like, stuff like that, you know? You just can't. It would just all come out wrong, you know? Did anybody pay? I guess you probably got it for free, Jesus. I wouldn't have paid, because I'd be like, well, I know I'm never going to see Jesus again. Let him pay. He's the boss. But then how weird it would be, like, 3 days later, after he rises from the dead, the resurrection, you run into him on the street, and the first thing he's like, dude, you should have paid. And you're like, ah, Jesus Christ, you're right. I think that's how Jesus Christ came about. Because they stiffed him at dinner, and then they ran into him after the resurrection, and they just felt weird. And that's the first thing that came out of, Jesus Christ, you're right. And then that's how the word Jesus Christ caught on, that phrase. That's my theory anyway, and I'm sticking to it. All right, my guest today is Virginia Grohl, mother of Dave Grohl. She wrote this really cool book called From Cradle to Stage. She interviewed 18 mothers of famous musicians. Dr. Dre's mom, Pharrell's mom, Amy Winehouse's mom, Adam Levine, goes on and on and on. And it's really, really cool book about the commonalities that these kids had when they were little. They couldn't sit still. They were very inquisitive. They were super into music, and the parents and these moms really fostered that and supported them. It's got vignettes from Virginia Grohl's life with her son David. Just a really cool book, like, that's great if you're a big music fan and you want to understand how these prodigies end up becoming such great stars and musicians, and a big part of it is because they were nurtured by their moms. And it's really cool. If you got a kid, they should read it. If you're a parent or about to be a parent, you should read it. It's like a great guide on how to be a good, cool, supportive parent. So check that out. Thank you for checking out The Paul Mercurio Show, new name. Spread the word, send some links around. I'm really excited about this interview. Really great conversation with Virginia Grohl. Hope you enjoyed my rantings, and we will see you next week. Hi, folks. Welcome to the show this week. Very excited to have a very special guest with a fantastic book, which I probably have to say is the best book I've read in the last 10 years. And my son is reading it, and my wife read it. The book is called From Cradle to Stage, and it's written by Virginia Grohl, the mother of Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters and Nirvana. And it's just a fascinating, great read. And Virginia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your more than kind words about the book.
Well, it's really quite amazing because folks have not heard about it, it's just the concept alone is really, really interesting. You interviewed 18 mothers of major era-defining musicians, like the mother of Dr. Dre, Kelly Clarkson, Amy Winehouse, Mike D of the Beastie Boys, Zac Brown, who my son loves, and we went to a Zac. It was our first concert, going to a concert together.
Oh, how great! Yeah,
my son Alex and I. So, and it is, and fill this in if I'm missing anything. But the book sort of chronicles not just your own history with Dave and music and inspiring him and being behind him to become a great musician, but these other mothers and their experiences. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. It was just a chance to sit down with them and talk like you don't get to talk to other women very often about very special things we have in common, because our lives have taken, you know, the same path in some ways, and yet very different avenues to get to the places where we've gotten. And besides, they all had really fascinating backstories, and that's what I was interested in, too, about, you know, where everybody had come from and how all the histories that were behind them and, you know, that what it is that makes up that special person that we're all so interested in, who is ultimately, you know, the son or daughter of the music star. But I love meeting these women. We all bonded immediately. We were, it was just like meeting a good friend instantly, because we have this really special thing in common. So, and a lot of our journey, we had things along the way that we had in common. So we got to laugh and complain about those together. So it was fun.
Yeah.
I loved every minute of it. Yeah.
Well, you know, you mentioned in the book, you know, Dr. Dre's mom said that Dre hated quiet, and when he was a boy, so he made sure the house was filled all day with music. Amy Winehouse couldn't sit still or concentrate. She'd burst out singing. And then vignette number 13, What's a Mother to Do, you say, and the way the book is written is really, really clever and great, because you have the mom's stories, but then within those stories, you have your vignettes about Dave, and you write about Dave. Your child is bouncing off the walls. He loves noise, his own or that produced by bands. He never slows down. He goes full speed. His teachers report that he can't sit still. He should probably be evaluated by the school experts. Maybe he has ADHD. But what you know, dear mom, is that this electrically charged product of your womb is an affectionate, thoughtful, funny, creative spirit. He loves to make you laugh. It's not going to be easy, but let me tell you a few things about your energetic child. How did you get, I know on family trips you all would, there would be music in the car, and the first song was You're So Vain with Carly Simon that he would sing along to in the car. Did you start to get a sense that, did you notice or observe that music was something that sort of calmed him down or satisfied him in some way?
Oh, yes. It was, I could tell how special it was. It had always been a big part of my life, but it didn't rule my life like it did in his particular case. And so I could see
you
that
were part
it
of a trio called the Three Bells, right?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah.
And it was fun. And I loved, you know, I always had music. I you know, honestly, until I was writing this book, I didn't realize how music had in some way dominated many of the years of my life, but I never saw it that way. It never seemed to be my priority, or it was just always one of the fun things I did. It was always one of the great places where I found happiness and where there, you know, was great joy in my life. But
and by the way, just let me say for people, for professionally, you were an educator. That was your life's
yes,
work.
Yes, I was a teacher for mm-hmm. many years, mm-hmm. and but his interest was different. It was more intense and just took up all his time. So it was almost beyond a priority. It was just a built-in necessity. And that's what most of them had in common. They just found the music and then it took them over. It was just so it was something that you had to notice and then you had to deal with. So and that the same thing about the energy level, that that double speed everything, that which, you know, which is, when I think about it now, it's the reason they all continue to succeed, because they converted that can't sit still kind of thing
right.
to workaholics. Like, you people don't understand how hard and how long these guys work.
Yeah.
And how little sleep they get. I mean, they're constantly writing and rehearsing and producing and getting it all together. It never stops.
Yeah, well, I'm a comedian, and it's the same thing. You know, I think people think, well, you kind of sleep till about noon or one, and then you watch some cartoons and drink a couple
right.
of beers and then go tell some jokes. And it is the art of it is to make it look like there's no work at all involved.
Yes.
But I totally understand and relate to how hard they must work. And it's funny, because I think if these children had been raised right now, maybe some of these brilliant musicians wouldn't exist, because it would be tamped down by an ADHD evaluation and then Ritalin and drugs and what. Like,
I wonder about that.
Right?
I know.
I
do think about that. I wonder, because there are still attempts to, you know, push them back into that that class full of all the others who are quite happy with the system as it is and can go to five or six classes a day and move from one to the other happily without thinking of what they're missing, without thinking of, you know, this other thing that they should be doing and which is music. So until somebody comes up with an answer to the way schools are organized and in tune with the people that they should serve, all of them, it's going to be the same kind of thing, I think.
Yeah.
It's too bad. I don't have the answer. I don't know. I have little pieces of it, but it's just, it's going to take a lot of work for somebody to address the needs of all the creatives, whether it's in music or art or food or science, the creative science thinkers too, although they are addressing that to some degree. They
yeah.
have interest. It's a big problem.
Did you and the other mothers find in common this? Did you, once you recognized that this thing was all consuming for your children, but also try to make sure that they had a full life as children and so that they would grow on to be well-adjusted adults, was that a priority? You know, make sure they play some sports or go on dates or I don't know, whatever it might be. Were you always conscious of trying to make sure that they didn't have a one-dimensional upbringing?
Yeah, and I think that well, first of all, they'd all started out that way. They all had sports in the backgrounds and or some other kinds of things that most of them had lots of friends too. Most of them were people that that got along with other people really well, and so they always had friends around them, and they were social and enjoyed the things that they were around, except for the school part.
Right.
And so we saw them as, really normal kind of kids. And also they had, I think the mothers all wanted to make sure that they had other adults in their lives that they were around. And so in some cases there were big families that they were a part of, that they made sure that they stayed in those family circles. So there were all different kinds of ways, but they weren't difficult children, except, as I said, for that horrible school part.
Yeah.
Friendly.
Did you try to, with Dave, it's mentioned that, school failed him. He just never connected in the classroom. And being an educator yourself and his mom, did you spend a period of time trying to, you got to do well in school, and then eventually realize that's not his path? Or did you instantly recognize that you needed to find another path for him?
Well, I don't know when it really occurred to me that how difficult it was to expect more than, when I had to get those report cards, which Mr. Stephen Colbert requested, he had done that in response to some comments that I don't know either I made or David made in the pre-interview, and then when I got them out and looked at them, it hurt.
Yeah.
Because some of the comments were actually mean.
You mean when you looked at them now years later, or at the time?
Yes, years later. And at the time, that one particular teacher, her comments on several occasions did rise to the point where I, when David came home with a note or something, I took the note, and the school was a block and a half away, and just ran out of the house in a huff and went right to her classroom and confronted or nicely asked, or however, I don't remember exactly, but did have to discuss some things with her. She was the only one that I really took on, I think. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I just kept hoping things would get better. Every year I thought, oh, maybe this year, maybe this teacher, maybe this class.
And was he just sort of chatty with his friends? Was he goofing around? Like, what was he doing in class? I mean, obviously he wasn't doing well with the grades, but was he disruptive in class on top of that? Or
not really. He wasn't really a problem child. He everybody liked him. His teachers all actually liked him. And they hated seeing him not succeed. He just didn't do the work.
Yeah.
He would be there, and he would not be thinking about what he was supposed to be thinking about or doing what he was just in another little world of his own.
Well, Dave writes in the book, his quote, "I was blessed with a genetic symphony waiting to perform. All it took was that spark, but beyond any biological information, there is love, something that defies all science and reason. There is a mother's love," which is a great tribute to you. What is that spark that he talked about? It sounds like something sparked, and then as the mother, you poured gasoline on it, if you will. I don't know if that's a bad metaphor, but something to that effect, maybe. But what was that moment? Because you talk about, there was a moment that sort of, for David, and maybe for you at the same time, where you go, okay, this is his path. Was there one particular thing?
Well, he talks about that epiphany that he had in the car when we were singing "You're So Vain."
Right.
And
he was six at the time.
I didn't know at that moment. He didn't say, "Mom, my life has just changed."
Right, right.
He didn't announce that. But I realized at some point that music was a center for him.
Yeah.
And so we always, we went to shows, all kinds of shows together. We went to, as I mentioned in the book, we went to listen to jazz on Sunday afternoons. And we went to hear Motown concerts at Wolf Trap Farm Park, which was this big outdoor, wonderful place. And I went to punk rock shows with him. And
how was that for you? How old were you at the time when you went to the punk rock shows? Do you mind my asking?
I was in my 40s, I guess.
Was that a bit of an eye opener, or was it?
Oh, indeed, yes. it was, and it was. One of those. Well, in D.C., it was the punk rock scene that he was part of was attached to some very positive movements, and one was, in fact, called Positive Force. And they were thinkers. They were people who wanted to make some things better, and they screamed about it in their music. Mm. I couldn't understand a word that they were saying, quite frankly. But I saw that the energy was translating from them to their audiences.
They were making a
connection. And it wasn't scary. It was a positive force, as they said. So yeah. They weren't the skinheads and the scary punks. There were those too. There were separate groups.
So when you went to one of these concerts, like the first time, he was pretty young, and then you smell pot in the air. Like, and was there that conversation at some point? Like, what is that, or what is that smell, or what is that guy that doesn't? It kind of looks like a cigarette mom, but it doesn't. Or how does that moment play itself out?
I don't remember a particular moment. We talked about drugs forever, because drugs. We lived in a suburb of D.C., and I taught in the high school there, so there were very few secrets. I knew who the drug dealers were in the school, and we both saw his close friends, the kids who had played on his little soccer team when he was 8 or 9 years old, getting caught up in it, and some going to jail while the rest of the kids were going to high school. I mean, this was a time when drugs were just really on the scene, and you couldn't ignore them. So we talked about it all the time. Mm-hmm. There were no big revelations about, oh my goodness gracious, someone's smoking pot, because that was something we were both aware of.
You were already sort of in the, you know, you write, this is like, this book is a combination of just incredibly interesting. I do this podcast because the long form interview on TV just has gone away for the most part, other than the Charlie Rose Show and Tavis Smiley. And I think people have great stories, and I'm fascinated by process. You know, like I interviewed Paul McCartney for my podcast. I've not talked to your son, but how these guys make music and hear that is fascinating to me. And to this foundation that you gave him and these other moms have given these brilliant artists is fascinating to me. And you say, so this book is also like a, and my wife said this, it's like a guide on how to raise your kid the right way, you know, but not in a way that like it's heavy handed or you're trying to be preachy. It just comes through. And isn't a quote that I think exemplifies that? You say, keep talking and listening, talk with your child about ideas, plans, worries about the future of the world, political views, neighborhood news, family, drugs, all of it. Talk in the car, around the table, sitting on the edge of the bed, and listen. And as old-fashioned as it may sound, I would strongly recommend face-to-face conversations rather than text and clever emojis, which is my favorite line in the whole book, because I have a big thing about that with my son. My son will text me, and then I call him, and he doesn't pick up the phone. Like, and I know the phone is in his hand. Sorry, I'm getting a little aggravated. And I'm a big fan of talking. So this idea of, obviously, you had to learn this along the way. You have David and Lisa, and you have two kids, but you had to learn this along the way raising your kids.
I was lucky that it was before all of that, that it was before these things that are in their hands now, like my grandchildren now, I see, took them over. And honestly, that was, I think that really made a difference. And it was the reason that when we were in the car, the three of us, and we spent a lot of time in the car together, that we could either listen to the radio or we could talk, or we could listen to the radio and sing together. And we didn't have the option of putting our heads down and looking to see who had a message for us or, you know, texting away or playing a game or something. So, so now it's more complicated and it's harder. And I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's...
it really was easier for us. And, but, you know, when I talk to all the mothers, that we all try to do that same kind of thing and keep as much of that open. Some realized what happens when you just try to lecture all the time, that you're just going to get, you know, tuned out. And
did you ever have David tune you out from time to time?
Oh, I'm sure I did. But, you know, he's so polite and kind, and he always has been. I don't know how it happened.
No.
He just came out that way. He's a good guy. He would never let me think that, so I didn't have to face that exactly.
That's great.
But now I still have the same problem with texting and know, phone. I too like the conversation better than the quick text.
Yeah,
I was thinking about that when I was thinking of Stephen Colbert. I was thinking how many people he meets in a week. It's so fascinating, and yet he just gets sound bites. Hmm. He doesn't really get a chance to have a deep conversation or a probing conversation or really...
Yeah. I don't know if you remember
show how he feels about that, but
yeah, I think that he loves people and he loves conversation. So I'm sure there's the level of frustration that you get 7 minutes and then you have to go to commercial. You know, for people who don't know, Ginny was on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert recently with Dave and was just terrific. And you know, he gets briefed, like all these hosts, they get briefed and, you know, on some talking points, and then they got to jump into it and then move on to the next thing. And you know, we live in a world of sound bites now, really, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think, you know, the podcasts have come along. It's been good for you know, getting information out there and getting people to hear these fascinating stories. And I found that, you know, with yours and there's a you talked about the mystical force that urges some of us to listen, to play, to sing, to surround ourselves with music. Is just that in the zeitgeist? Is that just something that you come out of the womb with? I've been trying to figure out in this book how much is nature and how much is nurture. And it feels 50-50 to me with most of these stories with you moms.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that? Or how does that play out for you in your mind?
I don't know. It's complicated, isn't it? I think it certainly starts with the nature part, and that part is so undeniable that part B, the nurture part, is the mother who is wise enough or aware enough or smart enough to recognize the inviolable existence of the nature part.
Yeah.
That it is there, and so you have to deal with it or enjoy it or nurture it or something, because it is there and it's going to be there and it's going to rule your lives to some degree. So, and that's not an awareness you get all at once. That just sort of seeps in over time and you begin to see it, or maybe you look back and see it and you wonder, because, you know, not many of us were that wise on day one of awareness that we charted a course, you know, with this great wisdom. We just sort of floundered our way through it for the most part, and we made mistakes, I'm sure.
And did you find that with all the other moms, too, like they kind of, it's almost like you're going down this path, and at any given point in time, the child is leading you vis-a-vis the nature, vis-a-vis the nature, right? And then some, and then other times you're leading the child. You get in front of the child and lead for a little bit. So it's sort of this yin and yang, right?
Yes, and you know, one of the great pleasures too of writing this was, I got to talk to many of the artists whose mothers I had interviewed, and their tributes to the mothers. Didn't you find that inspiring too, reading
yeah.
what they all said about the mother when they looked, and they hadn't read what I'd written. We just had short conversations over the phone for the most part, and they just had these great tributes for them. And I was really pleased with that, and the mothers were, of course, too.
Yeah, it was a real appreciation and an acknowledgement you know, like, but you know, again, like, you're flipping through the book, Patsy Noah, the mother of Adam Levine, page 95. This word comes up a lot. There was that spark, that kind of twinkle in his eye.
Right.
And almost every one of you moms use this kind of it's you know, use that word in some way, shape, or form, which is goes back
yeah.
to the I was really nice to see that the kids appreciated what the moms are doing, and I can say that because I'm a parent, and you know, my kid's into baseball, so there's like,
oh,
you know,
okay,
so it's similar, you know, you're schlepping here and you're schlepping there, and you're getting up
right.
early and you're doing that and you're making sure that they do their lessons. But yeah, what's it like? My mother has come to see me do stand up. What is it like to see what goes on in a mother watching their child on stage, whether it's, you know, not the first time they do a recital at school, but like now they're doing it as a profession in front of, whether it's Dave doing 200 people when he was a teenager or a stadium
right.
With Nirvana or the Foo Fighters. Are you incredibly nervous the whole time? Are you enjoying it? Like,
I sometimes get nervous.
Yeah.
I used to when he was newer at it.
Yeah.
Now, I always sit on the side of the stage, right behind the curtain, so the audience, except maybe a few people in the front row, can't see me, but I can see them because I love watching the audience. That's what is really exciting. I can see the band, you know, they're right in front of me, but I love seeing that energy in the audience that is so electric, and their movement, and their bouncing, and their singing every word, and you just see how important it is to them, how happy they are. That's just really, really nice.
How important were teachers along the way? Like Adam Levine's mom talks about Gart, an elementary teacher who was the first to discover
mm-hmm.
Adam's singing voice. Did you find that there were teachers, in addition to yourself or the other moms, that or mentors outside of the moms that played a role in you know, nurturing this?
Not so much, no.
Really?
That one was, he was really fortunate to have had those voices in his life. And I think they understood them. That was one reason I wanted to mention those people, because that was unusual. I'm trying to think if there were any others that reported that kind of support early on, because most of them had just the opposite of that. Most of them had people sort of standing in their way. Well, Amy Winehouse did, except that she rejected it. She had that one teacher and woman who operated a school and saw Amy's talent really early.
Mm-hmm.
And then invited her to this school that was very hard to get into, but Amy wouldn't follow the instructions, and really stupid, you know, really rules that were minor rules that Amy just would not do what she was told to do. That was all there was to it. So
yeah.
She missed out on that. But she did have somebody who would have been a mentor. Most of the others just sort of made their way, I guess. Yeah.
You spoke to Pharrell's mom, and this goes back to what you said a couple of minutes ago. It's on page 117 about these kids appreciating the moms and what they did. He recalls that they were complicated times, were always resolved with open communication, which is what we talked about a little bit ago, to prevent mm-hmm. greater problems from arising. Quote, this is Pharrell, mom was strict, but I appreciate it now, he says.
Right.
And that was really nice to see that time and time again, that, you know, sometimes people who become adults in any walk of life never quite get, you know, how much people did for them or what jerks they might have been when they were younger or whatever. But it was great
right,
to see
right.
the tribute that these kids were paying to their moms and acknowledged how important it was, you know.
Well, and all of these, or many of these people, not all of them, but many of them then go on to the stage of parenthood themselves.
Mm.
And so it begins to dawn, and I'm sure a lot of things are dawning on Pharrell these days.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's now got a brood.
Yeah.
And so he's, and when I saw Carolyn, Dr. Williams, his mom, she was the full-time mother of his son, Rocket, because he was off. I saw her in Miami, and he was in L.A. at the time doing The Voice. And so she was mothering his little boy for a while. And
oh, wow.
And that was fun. I got to meet little Rocket, and he was adorable.
Oh, that's cool.
And she and her husband were, you know, going through it all again. And she was loving it. So
yeah. Was there one thing as you got into this, you started to obviously find a lot of common threads with the other moms, but was there one thing in particular that surprised you that a lot of the moms went through that you went through? Or you know, maybe there were a couple of things where you like, oh, wow, I didn't realize this thing would be a common denominator among moms of great artists.
There was one that was just so amazing that was just across the board reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the age at which our sons and daughters committed to music. I mean, it almost signed an oath to do music and nothing else. And that was between 12 and 13.
Really?
That's
almost
very,
wow.
Almost, yeah, just across the board. That was the time. And, you know, when I think about that, that's a very early age. Who at the age of 12 says,
yeah,
I'm going to be a nuclear scientist, or I'm going to be,
right,
you know, a brain surgeon,
right,
or
right,
anything.
Right.
And yet they didn't really announce it, but they knew, and we knew. And then the other thing was, there was never any, as you hear today in the YouTube generation, there was never any mention of, I want to be rich and famous.
Really?
Nobody had that. No. That was never part of the story for the future.
So what did it do for these kids? Was it just a fulfillment of creating something out of thin air and then seeing and hearing people react to their, to the noise that they were making? Like, because I would think at 12 or 13, you're like,
just,
hey.
I guess they had, they just had the urge to play. Most of them, the performance part came later, and it was not as, it wasn't as guaranteed to be, some of them weren't sure they were good at the performing part in the
right.
beginning. But it was just that they were destined to do the music. They had to do the music.
Yeah.
I think David says now that he used to, when he looked at his future, he just always sort of thought, well, he could be a studio musician. You know, he could always find a job.
Yeah.
That's the way he thought about money. I'll always be able to make a living playing somehow. But he never thought, I'm going to get in a sensational rock band and change the face of music, you know, within a year.
Yeah.
He didn't, that wasn't part of his thought process at all.
That's incredible. Well, I just one other quick question. I mean, what if you hadn't, two-part question. Did you find any of the parents that you spoke to, or did you meet parents that you spoke to whose kids did not go on to do this because they weren't embracing it? Did you find some of these parents? It sounds like you didn't. It sounds like you embraced it from minute one, but some not embrace it and then eventually have to come around to it? Or were they all pretty much like you and just said, oh, okay, there's something going on here and I better get on this train with him or her?
Well, I think most of us got on the train pretty early.
Mm.
Some needed to be convinced, I think, and made it more difficult for the son or daughter. I think of my very good friend, Sandy Clark, whose genius son, Gary Clark Jr.,
mm-hmm.
You know, he was 12 years old, got a guitar, instantly played it, by the way. That was the other thing they had in common. They could pick up an instrument and play it.
Wow.
They just were good at it. They not only were good at it right away, they could play it right away. And there's magic there.
Yeah.
I don't know how you explain
and didn't,
that.
Didn't Dave, like, make his own drum kit, like, early on, like, put some stuff together and just when he was little?
Well, we never had a drum set in the house, so he just had little stuff he would put on his bed and make pound on that, because that was as close to drums as he could get in our house. Our house was tiny, so we just didn't have room for drums, and he got away with having friends in his bands who had basements or garages or spaces where they could have drums. So I got off pretty easy. The mothers were, Sandy had a hard time because she really thought he should continue a college education.
Mm-hmm.
And so that wasn't in his program. But now she's at the side of the stage for every show, and she loves it, and she understands now the whole story.
That's great. Last question for you. What if you hadn't been supportive? You can't speak for the other mothers, but what if you hadn't had the foresight and all of that to really acknowledge this and support Dave in it? What do you think he would have done? Would it have happened anyway? Was it inevitable?
I think so, and I think I would have been a very sad person missing out on a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you know, I also thought of that. I thought of the people that I asked to do interviews with and write about. I got turned down by some people, quite a few in the beginning.
Hmm.
And
why do you think they turned you down?
Well, I think because some of them might have been sad stories. And I don't know. Some of them were, I wanted to have as many women as I could represented.
Mm.
And I think more women turned me down than men. Mm-hmm. I mean, more of the mothers of women. And I think I understand that. I think maybe they're, expectation is that when somebody writes about daughters in music, they often write about their weight and their hair and their romantic lives and the gossipy parts of it.
Yeah.
And so many of the mothers are just more protective of the women. So as much as I tried to, you know, have more conversations with some of those mothers, I didn't get all of the ones that I wanted. But I think then others turned me down because they just didn't want to live through it again. And so it may be that I just sort of lost the sad stories along the way and natural selection kind of thing. I don't know.
Well, it's an unbelievable book. It really is. It's.
I'm so happy you like it, and I love it that your sons are reading it as well as your wife.
Yeah, well, my son plays music too, you know, and he's been.
Now, how old is he?
He's 17, and he's got, you know, we have someone common now. He's like writing songs with someone. So we've been very, since he was five, he's played the piano. He was doing viola for years in the school orchestra. So my wife and I, my parents gave me a guitar, and I had to teach myself on an album. That was not fun. So I never stuck with it. My wife didn't stick with it. So we've been trying to make music another part of his life. You know, just even if he just picks up a guitar with friends at a party and just, you know, whatever, he's not going to be. So so this just is such a great book for, and also for him to understand how life works and how you got to work hard, and it's not just inspiration and all of that stuff. It just is a really terrific book for parents raising kids or not, or kids, you know, just really good.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
I love hearing that. That's nice.
Yeah, well, the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target. It is it's a story of mothers who rocked and raised rock stars, and it's called From Cradle to Stage, and it's been a real honor to meet you and talk with you, and thank you for taking the time to be on the show, and best of luck with the book.
Oh, thank you.
And the grandkids and all that good stuff. So.
Yeah. Well, I hope to see you again. That was fun.
Thank you. Well, thanks for being on. Virginia Grohl, pick up her book. It's fantastic. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. That was Virginia Grohl, and how great is this? I'm telling you, just read the book. Get the book. It's really one of the best books I've read in the last 10 years. Thank you for checking out the podcast. Next week, we're going to have somebody really cool as well. A little something different off the beaten path. So stay tuned for that. And hope you enjoyed this week's show. And I will catch you on the flip side. Thanks, everybody.
A Westwood One podcast production.